Support for this episode comes from SAS. SAS is going all in on AI to help the world get more done with data. See for yourself in Las Vegas, April 16th to 19th at SAS Innovate, the data and AI experience for everyone and every role, from top executives to data scientists, engineers, analysts, and more. I'll be there leading a panel discussion about the importance of responsible AI. It's just one of the many sessions that will highlight the massive potential of AI. Visit innovate.sas.com and use the code CARA to save $100 on registration. I'll see you there.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
It's on!
Hi, everyone, from New York Magazine and the Vox Media Podcast Network. This is On with Kara Swisher, and I'm Kara Swisher. My guest today is Reed Jobs, founder and investor of Yosemite, a venture capital fund focused on cancer research. He's also the son of Lorraine Powell Jobs and Steve Jobs, both of whom I've interviewed many times over the years. Steve, of course, was the iconic co-founder and CEO of Apple Computer, who died in 2011. And Powell Jobs runs Emerson Collective, which does both philanthropy and investments in immigration, education, climate, media, and more. Yosemite is actually a spinoff from Reed's work as managing director of health at Emerson Collective. Its mission is to, quote, make cancer non-lethal in our lifetimes. It's both a lofty and very personal goal, since his own father died of pancreatic cancer, and the stakes are high. The American Cancer Society projects that this year we'll see 2 million new cases of cancer in the U.S., a new grim milestone. Our question this week comes from former Wall Street Journal tech columnist Walt Mossberg, who knew his father very well up until his death. That's coming up after a quick break. Support for this episode comes from SAS. SAS is going all in on AI to help the world get more done with data. See for yourself in Las Vegas, April 16th to 19th at SAS Innovate, the data and AI experience for everyone and every role, from top executives to data scientists, engineers, analysts, and more. I'll be there leading a panel discussion about the importance of responsible AI. It's just one of the many sessions that will highlight the massive potential of AI. Visit innovate.sas.com and use the code CARA to save $100 on registration. I'll see you there.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Support for this show comes from Virgin Atlantic. Travel can be stressful. I don't think that's a controversial take. Sure, we all love taking a vacation, and that moment we finally get a chance to relax, but we're always so focused on the destination that the journey just feels like a means to an end. Well, what if it wasn't? What if the time you spent getting there was just as enjoyable as the vacation itself? That's what Virgin Atlantic believes. That's why they offer loads of special extra touches that make your trip one to remember for all the best reasons. Picture this: you made it to the airport, checked in your bags, and finally have a moment to settle in before takeoff. If you're flying upper class, you could be putting your feet up in a Virgin Atlantic clubhouse at London Heathrow, with food made fresh to order and champagne delivered straight to your table with a tap of a QR code. I mean, it's rude not to, right? Once you're in the air, the experience continues with deliciously different dining, seriously comfy seats, and the best crew in the sky by miles. Check out virginatlantic.com for your next trip and see the world differently. Hi, Reed. Thanks for being here.
It's really, really great to see you.
So I'm excited to talk to you about your new venture firm at Yosemite. Let's start with your mission. The only thing on the website right now is a sentence. Yosemite aims to make cancer non-lethal within our lifetime. Lots of organizations talk about finding a cure. You say non-lethal. Explain the difference.
A lot of people have used the word cure and abused it a lot in the oncology space. So our first reaction was we have to be honest about where we view the science to be. And to have human cells, you always are going to have the risk of some mutation happening, a bad cell division, and cancer arising. In fact, all of us have precancer in us right now. Now, it's almost always taken up by our immune system, or your cells are able to move against it and protect themselves. Mm-hmm. But that risk is not going away. So instead of thinking about this like, you know, an infectious disease that you could vaccinate and then your immune system is primed and you're going to be immune to it, with cancer, a more realistic pathway is to figure out how you're going to eliminate mortality systematically across many different types of early and later stage cancers. That's going to likely, in our view, be a combination of next generation early detection, therapies, and really, really precise patient-based approaches.
So it's a little like this idea of we're going to cure cancer is what, a canard, or that it's more like AIDS? We're going to living with AIDS has become the way they talk about AIDS now.
More than anything, it's a little like cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. So if you think about cardiovascular disease 50 years ago, it was an end-stage disease. You went to the hospital because you were having a stroke or a heart attack. It was at the very, very final stages of that disease manifestation. And, you know, the results, you know, showed that. It was horrible mortality. Today, it's a disease of monitoring, early intervention, and targeted therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, you can monitor things like your genetic risk factors, your cholesterol. You can take interventions like statins, or you could have a valve replaced, or, you know, a ton of other different things. And you monitor this with good diagnostics, whether that's a calcium score or just a blood test, throughout your entire life. Right. It's really an area under the curve disease. You want to like eliminate the amount of time you have at risk. In some ways, cancer is going to be very similar in that you're going to see cancer probably arising quite a lot earlier in 10 years than you do today. And the therapies you're going to have for it are going to be significantly more targeted, both to the mutation specifically, but in our view, much more actually about harnessing your own body's natural anti-cancer powers against it. And that's really the basis of immunotherapy.
So the idea is, I don't want to say living with cancer, in that detecting it earlier, one, so that you can do something about it, because that's usually the case. And two, figuring out ways to cope with it in some fashion that's not lethal, doesn't kill you.
I would say treat it early on and not treat it when it's a late stage disease, as unfortunately far too much is.
Which is why the finding the cure idea. Is that just something that people do to keep going? Because I had dinner with Katie Couric last night. Obviously, she's raised $700 million, $800 million for different cancers. Is that I don't want to say the wrong way to do it, but when you think about how we've thought about it, does that have to shift? Because so much of it is around the cure for cancer.
No, I think cure is a very hopeful mind space to be. I think it's very accurate in some cases. It's just not going to be for every single case. And for folks like me, we really just want to view what is going to be the most tractable thing scientifically and how do we get those things to the clinic. You know, so we do things that aren't necessarily just therapeutics. We also do quite a lot of digital health work and quite a lot of diagnostic work. Those are indirect ways to eliminate mortality, but it's still really, really important areas for us to focus in.
So this VC is a spinoff from your work at the Emerson Collective. I want you to explain what Emerson is and how Yosemite is connected to it. This is something started by your mom, Lorraine Powell Jobs. Explain what Emerson is and then how it was connected and spun off so people understand.
Absolutely. So Emerson is my family's family office. It's located here in Northern California. The structure of it is that of an LLC. It's not a foundation. You know, many family offices take the form of a foundation, which is wonderful. With our structure, we're able to do a lot more foreign nonprofit investing very seamlessly. In subsequent large family offices have followed a similar path. Chan Zuckerberg, for instance, has the same structure. Mm-hmm. What this meant for me and the health team, and it was, by the way, marvelous to start this with her. You know, my entire family cares about cancer as much as I do. So, you know, the alignment there has always been incredibly strong. And we began doing grants, actually, to a bunch of researchers in the cancer space, mostly starting here at Stanford, just because it was right next door. Mm-hmm. And I became quite displeased with this because it was all a black box. You would give mm-hmm. money away to a researcher, which is a laudable and positive thing. And mm-hmm. maybe they'd give you like an email back a year later saying what happened. But right. it was completely unconnected to a new therapy. And it was even further away from patients. So while I was at Emerson, I quickly decided that I care about changing things for people. And we view universities as the wellsprings of all new innovation for healthcare. It's a very, very mm-hmm. different ecosystem than it is in tech. And we can talk more about that later. But by partnering with super early stage researchers, we were able to see what are their most ambitious ideas. We were able to leverage a lot of blind spots that other funders have. Mm-hmm. For instance, you know, surprisingly, a lot of people's most ambitious ideas, they're not able to get funded because people want to see more incremental progress as opposed to swinging for the fences. Mm-hmm. I like the opposite. I like people who are really going for it. So by using philanthropy to actually de-risk a lot of these early stage scientific assets, we mm-hmm. were then right there when they wanted to take the next step into starting a company. To get to people, the way the ecosystem works, it really goes through academic labs to biotech companies to pharmaceutical companies. Mm-hmm. Most of that's just driven by how risky this all is, by the very, very high, insanely high capital constraints. You know, a phase three clinical trial costs $1 billion and only one out of three is going to succeed. Right. Very few people can underwrite that.
Although when they succeed, it's enormous. But go ahead.
Although when they succeed, it's enormous, but there's a lot of sunk cost to be recouped as part of this whole ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So, and very few private companies are able to really assume that kind of risk. So by playing in the biotech space, what we're really able to do is identify the best areas in academic labs, partner with the academics, and build the absolute best, cleanest, sharpest companies we possibly can to get early clinical data to either then become, you know, companies in their own right that are going to go through clinical trials or partner with pharmaceuticals to do that themselves. So we just care about getting things to people as quickly as possible, and this was the most efficient way to do so.
The dual mission is investing arm and nonprofit, that you have a donor-advised fund.
Yes.
So you would start off with this fund and then move on to the investment itself.
We actually have done them both simultaneously. So the thing that we do a bit differently is some funds have a philanthropic component, but it's usually associated with the carry. Well, they'll take some of the money that they make and then put it, earmark it for a nonprofit, which is great. Mm-hmm. But from our perspective, we need to actually be like using this to seed research quite early on that ideally we can actually translate in the lifetime of the funds. So we're doing this both at the same time, both at the beginning. Now, this is quite unusual for a lot of other firms. One of the main reasons why this works really well in the life sciences is, you know, in tech, you've got the stereotypical, you know, founder CEO who's crusading to, you know, move mm-hmm. mountains. Right. My dad was a lot like this. And if you look at most, you know, top CEOs in the Valley right now, they're founder CEOs. Unfortunately, it's different in the life sciences because your founders are academics who usually have tenure and rarely want to leave their academic posts. They're more than happy to, you know, take a project so far and then hand it off to other people. Moreover, if they are going to join, you actually don't usually want them to be the CEO.
Right.
Because they're the very best at a super specific part of science, you know, whether that's, you know, mm-hmm. gene editing or immunotherapy. And why would you want to burden them with the administrative and fundraising needs of a CEO?
A startup. Right.
Exactly. So more often than not, if they're able to join, they're a great chief medical officer, chief scientific officer. They're on the scientific advisory board kind of pushing that forward. But the management is very, very different and disaggregated from the scientific work. So it's just a different model that we're dealing with. We sort of instantiated at Emerson. Mm-hmm. We worked there for years and we honed this model quite well. We then frankly saw the pace of companies coming out of our academic portfolio really growing mm-hmm. at a pace that we needed to bring external funding on to sort of match. I'll also just be honest with you, Kara. I wanted my own firm. Mm-hmm. My whole family always, you know, each generation we'll start our own companies. So at a certain level, it was a very natural, organic thing for us to transition over. Now, the relation with Emerson's still very close, but you know, it's more of a GPLP one. They're amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, they give us amazing support. We are extremely close, of course, on a personal level, but you know, they're alongside our other LPs on our LPAC, and it's been a clean break.
So talk about the companies you focused on. Where have you put your money so far?
Some of the areas we're really excited about are the next generation of immunotherapy. It's been likened quite a bit to software, which is not a perfect but not a terrible comparison. So right now today, the notion of leveraging your body's immune system to attack cancer specifically mm-hmm. has mm-hmm. been a really attractive idea for scientists for years. Mm-hmm. It took Jim Allison's work to really get this to have legs. He was mm-hmm. a researcher here at Berkeley. He's originally from Texas. And he identified not only the T cell receptor and how your immune system looks at things. We didn't even know how it sort of worked before. He really cracked that out. He also then figured out how you would block these receptors that get lied to by the cancer. Cancer's unbelievably wily. It will sort of use your own body's immune cloaking devices mm-hmm. against itself. And Jim is a hero of mine. He was the first person to win a Nobel Prize, not only for the discovery of something, but for developing the drug against it, which is just so wicked cool. Mm-hmm. He also plays harmonica with Willie Nelson a character. But, yeah. You know, since then, that was really the first generation of technologies there. Subsequently, we've actually taken this to the point where we can take out your immune system mm-hmm. and actually educate it to what the cancer is and have it attack that more specifically. Mm-hmm. Now, the amazing part of all this is it works incredibly well in a minority of cancers, yet it doesn't work for everybody. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of ideas about what drives that difference, but optimizing this so that it's not just 20% of people that this is efficacious for, but 80% is mm-hmm. likely going to take, you know, the next couple decades, but it's really where we're putting a lot of our bets. So there's quite a lot in that, whether it's, you know, figuring out these next generation cells as therapies mm-hmm. Or changing the microenvironment around the tumor to make it more amenable to this. Those are all areas that we're really, really deep into because we see them as critical to the next generation of immunotherapy.
And when you're dealing with this, a little unlike software, this is a lot more issues around privacy and in terms of treating patients, correct? You're doing a lot of digital health.
We do a lot of digital health. In digital health, what we're really looking at is actually remote care delivery and really putting data into the decision-making ecosystem. So mm-hmm. right now, physicians don't really treat people based on any outcomes data. They do it based on their training and correct. What they kind of grew yeah. up knowing. Mm-hmm. And about 3 years ago, the amount of scientific literature being published every day physically eclipsed the ability for people to read it in that given time.
Correct.
So
yeah.
it's unfortunately impossible to actually be up to date as a physician. And there's no data in the loop here at all. This drives really bad outcomes for patients and frankly mm-hmm. doesn't help physicians at all either. So figuring out companies that are really engaging with that in clever ways are huge areas that we're focused in. The other one I just mentioned was remote care delivery. So for the longest time, you know, if you were going to be in a clinical trial, you needed to live near an academic medical center that was hosting it. Mm-hmm. And there was a law passed about 30 years ago, which came from a good place. It said you can't pay people to be in your clinical trial, which is a good thing, by the way. That could be abused a lot. However, the downside of that was you couldn't reimburse people for things like transportation, for food, for housing, you know, if you need to stay by there. And generally, that added up to really prohibitive economic costs for most people to participate mm-hmm. in clinical trials. It's one of the reasons why, you know, if you look at who's participating, it skews wealthy, very Caucasian, yeah. very disproportionate to the rest of the population.
As always.
Something that was a silver lining for COVID was all these clinical trials couldn't really exist in hospitals anymore during COVID at the height of the pandemic because they were overrun mm-hmm. with COVID patients, of course. So what happened was pharmaceutical companies had to work through local physician offices. And they set up a lot of infrastructure to be able to do this, which continues to exist because it's a lot cheaper to recruit patients where they are as opposed to where you want them to be. And the accessibility and the quality of data that's come out since then has been enormously better. Figuring out how we optimize that and actually take that to the next generation is another big area that we're focused on.
Which are broken parts of the system. I just did an interview with Tom Skoka, who did a great story in New York Magazine, and he got all kinds of things happening to him. And he went to specialist after specialist, but it wasn't until he was able to get himself in a hospital that they were able to address it because of the broken system. He didn't have money. You know, they couldn't figure it out. None of the data was available to the other doctors. And it was fascinating, like how ridiculous the answer was at the end.
It's preposterous. No, to hopefully you don't have to, but to enter a hospital is a little like a time machine. You're sort of going back to about 1989. And I can't tell you how many patients have come up to me because they have gotten their medical records either in paper form. And in one case, I remember it was a floppy disk. And this was in like 2019, which is just so preposterous that it would be funny if it weren't for the severity of the stakes involved.
Absolutely. But the main thing you're aiming at is cancer.
Yes.
So is there any type of cancer that you have more or less hope about or something that's under-innovated, underfunded?
So we work across all cancers. You know, I have a personal history with pancreatic cancer. Most people who work in biotech on cancer do it for, you know, personal reasons. And I would say we see a lot of segmentation in terms of different cancers for sure. Unfortunately, pancreatic is likely going to be one of the final ones to see a lot of efficacy. There's two main reasons for that. It has very few mutations. It's just like the wrong ones, but it's only a small handful. And it gets basically scar tissue around it. Your body thinks it's a wound and tries to heal it. This has the unfortunate unintended consequence of sort of cocooning the cancer and actually protecting it. So it doesn't really become symptomatic until it's metastatic, and then, you know, and then the game's over. So unfortunately, you know, pancreatic, brain, ovarian, these are going to be ones that are going to take a long time to really get traction for. The good news is cancers that are far more common, so colon, breast, lung, prostate, these are seeing incredible advances, especially in colon cancer and lung cancer, which are the two highest incidence ones along with breast. So in the last 5 years, there's been new therapies and actually new early diagnostics for all of these that have been incredibly specific, and the populations you're dealing with are just enormous. So we anticipate a lot more mortality reduction in those areas. I would say if you look kind of the last 10 years, some of the most interesting things that have happened have been in really actually highly mutated cancers. So ironically, going back to the immunotherapy conversation, when you reveal cancer to the immune system, the more mutated it is, the more different from you it looks. So actually, the easier time your body has eliminating it. So things like melanoma that have the most mutations because it's from UV radiation and it's just, you know, off the charts, actually is the most highly treatable by immunotherapy. You might have heard of Jimmy Carter having metastatic melanoma. He actually had mets in his brain. And one immunotherapy treatment eliminated all of this, all of it. He's totally cancer-free. It's unbelievable. He's pretty incredible in his own right. But it shows that actually the more highly mutated cancers, which about 10 years ago were the very, very worst, have had the most traction.
The killers. Because I've had several people who have died very quickly, many years ago, of exactly that. Which was amazing. Now they're not at all worried about it.
Yes.
So you highly mutating cancers. That's really interesting. So you started, we'll get to pancreatic cancer in a minute. Your dad died of pancreatic cancer for people who don't know. But you started with $200 million plus in funding from a group of limited partners. You mentioned Emerson Collective, but John Doerr is also on the top of the list. He has long been interested in cancer. He has family history, not himself. But talk about how you raise the money. And what is that enough money? It seems like a small amount of money, actually, when I'm thinking of. But right now I'm dealing with artificial generative intelligence companies. So they're in the $1 trillion fundraising game.
I mean, yeah, we take it. But it's absolutely been an incredible start for Yosemite. So, you know, for us, and just for me, candidly, coming out of a family office, it really mattered a lot that we had backing from more institutional investors. I have a whole team that I built at Emerson that came with me. So mm-hmm. it was much more of a sort of later stage fund than a first time fund. Mm-hmm. I'm really proud that we were able to get endowments from a lot of universities on the East Coast to deal with us. Now
you have MIT, Rockefeller University, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center.
Yes, those are the announced ones so far. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for those, it was very just important for us to get those long-term institutions who have exactly the same time frames and sort of scientific focuses that we do behind us as well. Speaking for myself, you know, if it was solely comprised of people from Silicon Valley, that would mm-hmm. not really be the type of momentum we were hoping for.
Why is it important to have the MITs, the Rockefellers, the Sloan Kettering? Why is that important in this area?
These are all really large endowments that are run as institutional capital, and they're very active, frankly, backing early stage managers because they're such long-term capital providers and because they have the luxury of, mm-hmm. you know, having an endowment that's going to be around for the next 100 years, they can look at that time scale. So that alignment was something that we were really, really searching for because a lot of people don't have that kind of patience and don't have that sort of mandate.
Sure.
So that, you know, composition was really much more how we look at things because yes, we're a venture fund, but more than anything, we have just hardcore fidelity to the science. Mm-hmm. And we don't, again, one of the reasons why we eschew the word cure, we want to be really honest about what is the very, very best state of the art and how can we, you know, improve it? How can we take, you know, ambitious but logical bets here? And that kind of thinking is exactly the framework that most universities have. Something I am excited to announce mm-hmm. is on Friday, Yosemite announced a partnership with the American mm-hmm. Cancer Society
okay.
on our first inaugural tranche of Yosemite grants. Mm-hmm. So this is the first time since really launching this program that we're really beginning our first round of grant funding. Mm-hmm. It's in the areas of tumor microenvironment, several AI topics, and mm-hmm. You know, one more in early detection. And all of these are areas that we've, you know, spent quite a lot of time as the investment team thinking about, you know, how we want to see progress forward. And partnering with such an amazing philanthropic institution has been a mm-hmm. big, has been a change for us and mm-hmm. one that we were really, really excited to announce.
And this is to pump the system, I guess, right?
There's no strings attached. So mm-hmm. we don't have any IP rights or any ownership to any of these. Mm-hmm. It's really just to promote the very, very best ideas out there.
So that, well, then later you can be aware of them or put them in the direction you want them to go in, correct? Because there's been attempts in Silicon Valley to do this.
Well, it depends though, Kara. You know, we're not looking necessarily to shoehorn companies. We mm-hmm. obviously care about that as an outcome, but we've been funding, for instance, things in the microbiome space for years. You know, all the bacteria that live in your gut, they find mm-hmm. their way into tumors. It's really interesting how it works. There's a lot of connections between that and your neurological and immune systems. And we've never actually invested in a company in that space. Certainly, it's not because we don't find the technology or the area interesting. We just don't believe it's mature enough. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. We continue to look at applications today. So I would just say it shouldn't just be looked at as a purely incubation model. We want to meet the science where it is and just progress it along in the right way.
Can I ask you, when you think about, you mentioned Silicon Valley, I've been in so many dinners of like going to cure cancer kind of stuff. There's a bunch of awards they're trying to do. I know Yuri Milner was trying to do it and various people. How does it differ from the Silicon Valley version of this? Like, because there's been a lot of attempts, but there certainly are a bunch. How are you different from the venture capitalists in biotech right now?
So our engagement with universities with a no strings attached basis is quite unusual in biotech. There's a few people that do this with a few universities. We cast a much wider net. Mm-hmm. And we are really one of the largest funds focused on a single disease area. Mm-hmm. You're seeing a little bit more of this in the neurological space.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you know,
a few funds have done this as a sleeve of one of many funds. Mm-hmm. But no one else has really, as far as we know, been as focused at this scale. So already that's incredibly differentiated from a lot of the other firms out there. Mm-hmm. And our focus on really early stage cancer work is something that other people do. You know, we collaborate and we syndicate mm-hmm. with people all the time. But that, you know, bullseye is something that other firms don't really have.
We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
Support for this show comes from Ramp. Are you overwhelmed with managing your business expenses, vendor payments, and accounting? Is your finance software just not cutting it? Or maybe you're just looking to cut all that wasteful spending. Ramp could be a total game changer for you and your business. Ramp is the corporate card and spend management software designed to help you save time and put money back in your pocket. Ramp gives finance teams unprecedented control and insight into company spending. With Ramp, you're able to issue cards to every employee with limits and restrictions and automate expense reporting so you can stop wasting time at the end of every month. Plus, Ramp is easy to use. You can get started, issue virtual and physical cards, and start making payments in less than 15 minutes, whether you have 5 employees or 5,000. Not only that, but Ramp can save you money. They estimated that businesses that use Ramp save an average of 5% the first year. And now you can get $250 when you join Ramp. Just go to ramp.com/Kara, ramp.com/Kara, ramp.com/Kara. Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him, the sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money where he earns 5% annual percentage yield, so he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks.
Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prof G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds 4 times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
I want to talk about the future of cancer research in a second and biotech field in general. But every week we get a question from an expert, from someone you might know, I think. I'm not sure if you do, but let's listen to it.
Hi, Reed. This is Walt Mossberg, former technology columnist at the Wall Street Journal and co-producer of the D conferences. I knew your father well, and I think I even may have met you once briefly when you were a kid at your parents' home. I have a two-part question. First, what qualities of your father's do you think you have adopted in your career? And secondly, were you allowed full use of screens and digital gadgets and games and other software when you were a kid? Or did your parents have limits on that?
Oh, Walt. Anyway, that's a good question. Answer the last one first. I'm just curious. I am curious.
Oh, sure. We did have restricted access. Restricted is the key word there. You know, a lot of teens kind of rebel from their parents. You know, maybe they... have a girlfriend they don't like or, you know, change their appearance. In my case, I carried a Razer flip phone with me for about 3 years in high school unnecessarily, because, you know, when you're 15, you're pretty stupid.
Yeah, this is a Motorola. So, I love that flip phone.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a good phone.
So that was my form of rebellion at the time. Uh-huh, yeah. But no, we of course did have, plenty of access, but we all were... frankly, such hardcore students, and we were all so nerdy that it wasn't really much of a distraction, and we never really played many games. We just weren't really ever a gaming family.
So what qualities have you adopted? Not just your dad, but your dad and your mom. How do you think of yourself?
Well, I would say I've learned so much from my mom, really just about judging people and the quality of the people you partner with. She has an amazing eye for talent, for for potential, and that's something that I've really tried to cultivate in myself. Which, you know, if you're leading a firm, is actually one of the most important things. You know, from my dad, it's the simplest thing, but I would just say, I get up and I love what I do every day, and it makes me so much better at it. And obviously, you know, his story and his journey was a big part of why I'm here. Mm-hmm. And I actually love that I can still feel connected that way, and that it's actually making a difference. Some of these things are working. Like, right. the potential for what we're funding right now in a couple of years of development is off the charts cool. Mm-hmm. And one of the really interesting things I love about medicine that is actually true in tech that he was great at is seeing how, you know, innovation comes from all these orthogonal places. Mm-hmm. And it's such a synthesis problem where, you know, you can read the very best data in the world and actually it'll be a researcher studying something completely different that comes mm-hmm. up with the breakthrough. And being super flexible, being open and having beginner's eyes towards all this is actually critical to continue to be successful.
Yeah, I thought orthogonal is an excellent word. Your dad did see orthogonally, and it's very hard to do so, you know, and it also, people resist that, right? They resist the ability to, everyone wants you to go the way you're supposed to go. And I imagine the pressure is enormous to do that among everybody around. And I think you're right, but especially in creation of new things, you have to go a totally different way, even if you displease people. Now, you were actually involved in biotech at an early age as a summer intern in oncology labs at Stanford in high school. One of the things your dad is quoted in is in a biography is by Walter Isaacson was that your interest in biotech was a silver lining of his getting sick. What did you think when you read that? Not, you don't have to comment on the book, but in general, do you think that was the case to get you here?
Of course. Absolutely. It is a silver lining. I don't think that's a bad way to put it at all. Again, most people who work in cancer do it for very personal reasons. And the drive that that gives you is not what most people have in most jobs. Mm-hmm. It's not something that, you know, it's something you pay for very, very dearly. But it is valuable and it matters a lot. It matters a lot to me. I would just say the thing that stuck with me from his experience was not just getting incredibly passionate about this, but I was fortunate enough to join him in a lot of his tumor boards. And we would meet with some of the very best experts in the world. So from a very young
explain
age—
Explain what that is. Explain what the tumor boards are.
A tumor board is a meeting of top oncologists, researchers from different areas to review a case. This happens for complex cases. It happens all the time. It's a very normal thing. And because of knowing Art Levinson and having worked in the space for a bit.
This is the Genentech head. That's who's on the board of Apple.
Yeah. You know, I learned about gene sequencing, about really the cutting edge of biotech quite a long time ago. And I've never really lost, you know, a lot of those connections and a lot of that exposure. So the foundation for what I'm doing now was established quite early, even if, funnily enough, those particular innovations are a bit expired by this point.
For people who don't know, Steve Jobs, he was one of the first 20 people in the world to have all his genes of his cancer tumor sequenced, which was amazing. It was an amazing thing. This was May of 2011.
That's right.
We were studying at Stanford, which was quite early. So even in his illness, he was trying to find something new in it, which I remember him talking to me about this. I thought, this is not the last thing I would do. But he, in fact, was very interested in it as a thing versus just his own personal struggle, which I thought was fascinating.
It is. And, you know, since then, the cost has come down about a thousandfold. You know, it used to cost, the first human genome was about $3 billion in 2003. Now it's less than 1,000. So even though there's limits to how useful all the sequencing is, it's a critical layer in figuring out someone's care.
As they're going forward. And eventually, it'll cost nothing. That'll be the beginning of the care, correct?
That's That's right.
That's easily sequenced. I don't think it's a weird thing to say that my dad's death, my dad died much earlier when I was five, formed everything I ever did. Everything. There's nothing that I don't do that I don't think of him. Mostly time. The time you have, which is something your dad talked about and everything else, in terms of how you move through life and how you get things done. I think most people who have had that happen do have that urgency, I guess. Urgency.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's what propelled me to start. When I was 15 in cancer labs, we were sequencing colon cancer tumors. I really learned everything I could for these tumor boards. I, you know, tried to at least have a point of view on everything. And though, you know, he obviously didn't make it, I do believe that that generation is going to be one of the very last to have so few options. And I see it moving incredibly differently for people who are my generation and younger. Now, again, I think, to be honest, pancreas is going to be one of the very last ones to go.
It
was, you know, just very unlucky. He had a rare form of cancer, and those are extremely difficult to treat. The good news is there's many that are far more common that are having much more traction.
That are lethal, that shouldn't be.
That's
necessarily.
Right.
So when you think about that, I'm just curious, you didn't become a doctor or a scientist, correct? You're doing venture firm.
Yeah.
Why that choice? Because you certainly could have become a doctor easily.
So the
my brother's a doctor to follow my dad who died. But
well, that's beautiful.
When I think about it. Yeah.
My decision, like a lot of kids, I was thinking of going very far away for college. But he was getting pretty sick, so I stuck around it. I went to Stanford, which turned out to be amazing. And
it's not bad. I've heard it's a good school.
It was a good fit, but it's quite close to my, you know where I grew up. It's pretty close to home.
The local college. Yes, I'm teasing.
So I didn't take time off after he passed away because it was really important for him that I finish college. Even though he dropped out, actually, he cared a lot about finishing college. And just to be frank, it was personally really hard for a couple of years. I was pre-med at the time. You know, I was taking all the organic chemistry and all the kind of prerequisite classes. And I had about 2 years where I really was a bit allergic to cancer. I just couldn't really deal with it. Honestly, I'm a little ashamed of that. I wish that hadn't been my reaction, but it is what it is. And, you know, that was what I went through. So I ended up, you know, changing majors because if I didn't want to do cancer, I had to do something else. So I always have loved history, and I did a program actually studying nuclear weapons in Stanford's International Security Program.
Wow.
Which is, you know, a little more cheerful.
Yeah. cancer, nuclear weapons.
Yeah, exactly. but it was honestly incredible. And I actually even got a master's studying some of that. I was contemplating, I could do academics. I'd worked kind of all around actually where you live now in Washington. But I decided, and this is when I was 24, one of the biggest decisions of my life, I really knew that it wasn't the battle I really cared about. And I didn't think that it was the kind of impact I wanted to have. I'm sure I could have done a good job at a think tank or something, but you're still just at a think tank. So I took about a month of introspection, and I just realized that ultimately cancer was the thing I'd always cared the most about, and it was really, it was unfinished. So that was right around the time that I was finishing up my graduate work, and that's when I figured out what Emerson was doing, and I asked if I could take a lead there, and the rest is history.
Interestingly, something your father did say was that one of the biggest innovations of the 21st century will be the intersection of biology and technology. I think this too. I think it's really important. And also climate change is the other one I think is probably going to be the big area too. But there are currently only 4 cancer vaccines that have been approved by the FDA to prevent cancer. Do you think we're going to see more, and for what types of cancer? I want you to sort of, you don't have to predict everything, but where are we right now in that regard?
Cancer vaccines have been this really tantalizing idea for a long time.
It is.
You know, if cancer is a different thing, can you prime your immune system for it? That way it'll identify it and boom,
there you go.
Yeah. Kill it. How awesome would that be? It has never really worked. The vaccines you're talking about are for virally mediated cancers, for HPV, for hepatitis, for those kinds of things. That is not most cancers. Most cancers are not, you know, turned on by viruses. They might be impacted by them a bit, but it's not the driving factor. What you're talking about is a prophylactic vaccine, is something you take, you know, preventively, which is totally the dream. Now, that hasn't ever worked, really, just because you need to be incredibly precise with what you're going after. Because remember how I said, you know, all of us have kind of proto-cancer in us. Well, most of that is not actually going to really matter that much. Most of it will get cleared out.
Right, because it doesn't activate. Right.
It doesn't activate. And unless you're going to be crazy precise about when is the right point for your immune system to recognize that, it's really hard to be able to design something like this. My own instinct, and this is just my own view, is it's one of those things that doesn't work until it does. And then, then oh my gosh. So it is something that we have research that we're supporting. There was a paper from BioNTech that came out about 6 months ago, and actually in pancreatic cancer. It's a small phase one, but they had about a 50% response rate for a phase one trial. I wouldn't read a ton into that, but it shows that it's still a very active field, and especially as we've gotten better at vaccines, that also changes what we can work with. So it's a super interesting idea, but but it's super early.
You've also worked with Jennifer Doudna, who won the Nobel Prize for a method for genome editing called CRISPR. What are the new developments you're seeing in this field for cancer?
We do a lot of work on both the gene editing side and actually on something called the epigenetic editing side. And those two things are somewhat similar but have different applications. So with CRISPR, right now, one of the big things we're working on is the delivery issue. So basically, if you think about gene editing like a copy and a paste, CRISPR is sort of half of that. It's incredible at cutting out with single gene specificity things along the genome, which is incredible. It's not really good at pasting things in. So you can't replace a bad gene with a good gene. But for instance, there's many diseases that are called monogenic diseases, one gene, where you have one mutated gene that's causing the whole disease. So you saw this recently
with—
Just take it out and that's that. This is like sickle cell anemia, Huntington's disease, which is awful. And you know, several other kind of neurodegenerative developmental diseases. Those are the areas you're going to start with that. However, right now the issue for a lot of other applications is you can't deliver this with any kind of specificity. So, like, let's say I had a problem with my kidney. You can't give me a gene therapy that just goes to my kidney as an organ. It'll go to every single cell in my body, and that's not acceptable from a safety perspective. So figuring out the next generation delivery modalities that don't have that problem and have much more specificity is sort of where the field is right now. And long story short, there's a giant race happening. There's dozens of companies pursuing this. You know, we're involved with some of them. It's a big deal. And it's really the next stage of where that technology is going, is cracking the delivery problem.
Just, you said something that just caught my ear, where you said that you don't know what's the dangers are involved. I know when I interviewed Doudna, she was very concerned about that, not just clone, everything. She was concerned about everything she had done and the misuse of it. Is that, that's not something you are concerned about, or you're, that's your, within your purview, correct?
That is certainly not in my purview. I think it's an interesting kind of cocktail conversation. it's a long way away from being something that I would say is a serious concern, just because this technology is so nascent. However, these are fields moving incredibly fast. So Jennifer, everybody is right to keep this as a serious concern. I think, frankly, her leadership in that from a moral perspective has been amazing. And the last thing in the world we want is for this to be abused by people.
Which brings me to AI, because that has a lot less safeguards already, or none at all. So talk about the shift AI is making in cancer research. There's much ado about gene folding, and I've heard it called a quantum leap. Let's talk a little bit about how AI shifts this and what investments you might be making here or you think is important.
I kind of break it down into three areas.
Okay.
It's AI really right now is affecting diagnostics, drug discovery, and then there's kind of the sandbox of what could you build. In terms of diagnostics, this is happening a lot with radiology and pathology, where it's a very easy transition to make because it's pattern recognition and image recognition. So already some of the things you're seeing, which I think are amazing, are identifying like micrometastases or super early tumors that might be obscure to a radiologist's eye through AI. These are software plays. You could easily put these into imaging systems, whether that's a PET scan or MRI. And that transferability is happening very quickly. You're not going to be replacing radiologists, but you will be improving them better than the very best in the world. Right. This is quite tractable and is happening quite soon. So I would say that's one area that we're incredibly excited about. Frankly, it's not one that we're investing a lot in because it's already quite mature. So it is not the best fit for venture.
So that's detection.
That's early detection.
Okay.
Now, with drug discovery, the notion broadly is, you know, could you model proteins out to find basically druggable niches in them without having to do super expensive X-ray crystallography? And could your library of drugs that you have, maybe as a pharmaceutical company, maybe as an academic, be able to go in there and do what you want it to do? This is a super big deal because it's not really replacing people, but it's accelerating the pace of innovation by an order of magnitude. So already a lot of companies are, you know, putting a ton of resources into this. They're all somewhat constrained by what their internal libraries are and what they can test against. You know, if you're a company, you can usually test against what you have and that's about it. But this is still a an incredibly important deal. And just as a little anecdote, we've seen, you know, places that we could make drugs in areas that were previously thought of to be untouchable. There's a couple oncogenes that we didn't really see any parts that we could make anything to perturb, now have potential candidates. They may not work, but we've gone from nothing to candidates at the very least, and that's a big deal. So I don't want to diminish the effects here. The acceleration has been enormous.
Explain what an oncogene is for us.
An oncogene is something that's promotive of cancer in a way that is a bit unstoppable. So a good analogy is like someone who has a stroke while driving and their foot is on the gas pedal. It's a little like that. One of the classic examples is something called epidermal growth factor receptor. So every cell in your body has this receptor to tell it to divide. So like, you know, in adolescence, when you're growing, your cells are dividing a lot because you have to grow. And every cell needs this signal. For many cancers, when they get advanced, this pathway becomes mutated and it basically becomes turned on all the time. This is what drives a lot of the uncontrollable growth. It could be on the top of the pathway. It could be kind of downstream. Doesn't really matter. The point is that the entire cell is getting this signal to just divide constantly. And that's the kind of thing where you need to basically just like either disrupt that signal or just shut that off entirely. And it's a very, very complex thing to do.
Right. And treatment, that's the last bucket, was the right treatment itself.
That is getting a little bit more complicated. You know, for that, we're really interested in looking at, say, patient modeling and for certain aspects of clinical trials that you could probably model out instead of have to recruit patients for. You know, one example is something called the synthetic comparator arm. So this is a little wonky, but basically, you know, instead of having one arm on, the drug that you're testing and one arm that's the standard of care. If it's something that's really common and the standard of care is being reproduced across a lot of different trials, could you work with the FDA to make one standard of care that is just conserved across all those so you don't have to keep recruiting patients for it? And that's one promising area.
Of AI. So do you think that AI is going to change every aspect of life sciences and biotech? And what are your concerns? Those are two separate questions. But do you think it has to be changing everything, given it's also an idea generator, right, beyond human recognition of it?
That's a really interesting question in terms of what is it going to create in terms of new knowledge. And that's an area that no one really knows the answer to. We're thinking about this a lot. For me, it's one of the more fascinating aspects of this that is really unique. Now, I'm sure it will not change every aspect of medicine. I don't want to, you know, be too promotive of the hype there.
Well, you're the only one in Silicon Valley who isn't, but go ahead. Why don't you call yourself Yosemite AI and see what happens?
Oh, my gosh. I think we're going to pass on that one. I think Yosemite's pretty great just standing alone. But
And any concerns? What are your concerns when they apply AI to everything? What is your biggest worry?
I guess my biggest worry, and this is not something I have a lot of control over, is that if we dramatically accelerate the process of drug development and drug discovery and clinical trials, that mm-hmm. doesn't translate into lower costs.
So it doesn't really help people.
That's right.
So I have two more questions. When you come to the end of your life, what would you hope would be the result of what you did? If you could pick one or two things of these efforts you're making. And secondly, you grew up in Silicon Valley. You've seen the ups and downs. You've obviously been at the center of it. How do you look at it right now? You know, there's, you know, the hugeness of these companies. How has it changed from your perspective, the wider tech market, not just biotech, but all of tech?
Sure. So to take them one at a time, I only think that anyone is going to really do two or three great things in their life. That was something that my family kind of has drilled into me, which is you have to focus what you're going to be good at, and you have to pick extremely disciplined and diligently, which is really hard. What that means on a daily basis is you have to say no to things you desperately want to do because it's not quite as important as the thing you need to do, which is extremely difficult, and I still haven't totally mastered that. But ultimately, I want us to be part of a few amazing companies that really change the paradigm on how we think about cancer. And that's likely going to be both on the diagnostic side, on the therapeutic side, and likely on the digital health side as well. But all of these systems, whether it's, you know, hospital systems that haven't been updated since the late 90s, or the way that we're thinking about, you know, immunotherapy and gene editing, and it's just the beginning of all these things. And you can kind of see how they could be combined, but it's still so early. Mm-hmm. Figuring out where that story is going to be written and having Yosemite play a role in that, ideally a prominent role, is really what I'm aiming for. I agree that I think this is the biological century. It's one of the most important places, not just in the economy, but for people, for ideally millions of people who will unfortunately suffer through these diseases. If we could make that significantly better for a large chunk of those, that would be us succeeding beyond my wildest dreams. So I would say, you know, patient outcomes is the yardstick that we're measuring against. It's going to take a long time, but being part of great companies that help move that significantly is the biggest thing for me. Mm-hmm. In terms of just your question on the Valley, it's amazing to see how the incentives have really changed. And I hope to be a bit of an old school type that cares about making a few great things. Mm-hmm. That mindset hasn't really lasted or been preserved that well, in my opinion, in the last, you know, couple decades, mm-hmm. for a whole host of reasons. But I just really believe that at its very best, this place can make things that really take people's breath away and that can really, really change the world in an unambiguously positive way. And for us and for myself, that's, you know, the spirit that I still hold, mm-hmm. and that I really just want us to bring to the table every day.
Just so you know, you're one of the first people who said the word people to me in technology. Your dad talked about people and consumers, but I would agree the narrative has been lost in a lot of ways from something. But people should be the focus of everybody. That's always been my goal. But I really appreciate this, Reed. This is such a thoughtful interview, and I wish you the best in this. This is a wonderful way to spend your life. You know, I hope I'm not being pretentious, but your dad would be very proud of you.
Oh, that's sweet, Kara.
He would be very proud of the stuff you're doing. Yeah. On with Kara Swisher is produced by Naeem Araza, Christian Castro-Rosell, Kateri Yoakum, and Megan Burney. Special thanks to Mary Mathis, Kate Gallagher, and Andrea Lopez-Cruzado. Our engineers are Fernando Aruda and Rick Kwan, and our theme music is by Trackademics. If you're already following the show, you get a Motorola Razr. I actually still have mine. If not, keep doom scrolling. Go wherever you listen to podcasts, search for On with Kara Swisher, and hit follow. Thanks for listening to On with Kara Swisher from New York Magazine, the Vox Media Podcast Network, and us. You can subscribe to the magazine at nymag.com/pod. We'll be back on Monday with more.